You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls, with your host, Michelle Jaffe.
Welcome to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are so honored to have our guest on our program today, Vidya Khan, who is an incredible woman who has paved the way for Bangladesh in the garment sector. So this is going to be a fantastic conversation that we will be having with Vidya. And Vidya, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm good, thank you. And yourself?
I'm excellent, thank you. And, you know, we are just so glad to have you on the show. You have a very interesting background, and I think that the work that you're doing is intriguing as well. So we have a lot to talk about, and it should be fantastic. So first of all, just to introduce yourself, I'd love to get to know more about your family's history in the garment industry in Bangladesh, if you would.
Basically, my father he started off as a civil servant of Pakistan. Back then, Bangladesh was still a part of Pakistan. So he started off as a civil servant, which he later then became the district commissioner of a district in Bangladesh, and then he had these government services. And then 1971, it was declared that we would go into our liberation war, at which point he became a freedom fighter and fought the war. And it was under him that the first part of Bangladesh, namely a district called Pabna, was liberated. Of course, the war ended. He remained in service with the government. He was the first establishment secretary of the government of Bangladesh. He was responsible for the makeshift government which we had in Calcutta, called Mujib Nagar government at that time. After the liberation war, he helped shift that government to Bangladesh. There was a very interesting story whereby the Pakistanis were taking all the money from our treasury in what was Bangladesh back then. He stopped the train. A lot of exciting stories, changed the currency back before it all became obsolete in Pakistan, and things like that. So he was a huge patriot, which later made him decide that once Bangladesh was liberated and he realized that there wasn't any industry as such, but there were lots of people, so labor was readily available, of course lots of women, and we didn't have any industry. At the same time, I think it was Nixon and Kissinger who decided on the multi-fiber trade agreement and also calling Bangladesh a bottomless basket case. So at that time, Daewoo's factory in Busan, Daewoo basically from South Korea, they were looking for additional capacity to produce because I suppose Korea was given a quota. And my father and the president of Daewoo was called Mr. Kim, I suppose. And they came into a joint venture agreement where my father did the 100% investment. He took 130 people, 18 women for the very first time in Bangladesh. They were all sent away to Daewoo's factory in South Korea, in Busan, for 6 months, where they were trained in all the skills of manufacturing garments and also the commercial part. So everything from banking, marketing, commercial, logistics, they were trained in all of these separate techniques and instruments. 6 months later, they came back and essentially the very first 100% export-orientated garment factory was set up in 1979 in Kalukat in Chittagong, which is the port area of Bangladesh. And that is pretty much the history of the garment industry in Bangladesh. Once the factory was set up, he then realized that the banking instruments, the financing part, wasn't available in the country. So the governor of the Bank of Bangladesh, the late Mr. Nurul Islam, who was also a colleague of my father's from the civil service of Pakistan and things like that. So he then negotiated with the governor of the bank that the back-to-back letter of credit system should be integrated and available for this garment industry or the factories that were then being set up much later. So he formulated the back-to-back letter of credit system, the banking system, which is now a very, very, it's basically the background of the garment industry in this country. And he also formulated the system of the duty-free bonded warehouse system. So anything that was brought into Bangladesh wasn't taxed. It was kept in a bonded area within the factory. Goods were not taxed. They were brought in, they were stitched. And again, then they were exported so that prices remained competitive in the global market. These were some of the key instruments that he also formulated in order to complement the garments industry that he had set up. So that's pretty much the history of the garment industry in Bangladesh.
And that is such an amazing story, and what of such an intriguing background. I want to remind everyone who's just now tuning into our show that you are listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls. We are once again talking with our guest today, Vidya Khan. Now, Vidya, you received your education from outside of Bangladesh in the UK. So what brought you back to Bangladesh?
Well, given that I had lost my father a week into being admitted into boarding school, there was always that feeling of wanting to come back to being close to family. I lost my father when I was 18. I came back to Bangladesh when I was about 25. And there was this emptiness, you know. I wanted to be next to family. There was a bit of a paranoia. I thought, you know, what if something happens to my mother? And I missed my family, basically. So I wanted to come back. There was that personal factor. Also, you know, I had studied to become a barrister. I had become a barrister. And when we're young and we start off and we think that we want to become doctors and we can probably save the world and that we can become lawyers and save, sort of help all the women and children and things like that. So I had that idea in me too, that by being a lawyer and by coming back to Bangladesh, that I would be able to help people who needed me. You know, I had a more pro bono attitude towards practicing law.
Right.
Of course, when I did do it in reality, it was a whole different story. And of course, I had my family business there also, which was many different various things. And I weighed it all up, and then something made me decide that I didn't want to practice law anymore and that I wanted to be a part of this family business. Also, essentially, because my father had left behind so much for us, such a huge legacy, that it was very interesting to want to see what we ourselves were all about.
Well, I'd also like to know from you, you know, having been exposed to what the garment industry has done to Bangladesh, do you believe that it would be fair to say that the introduction of this industry to, you know, your country caused a social revolution in that country?
It caused a social revolution. It caused a silent social revolution, as far as women empowerment was women empowerment is concerned. Of course, it caused a huge economic revolution, and that was open and out there and apparent. But like I had said, then it was the first time that women were sent abroad to be trained in such a manner. When my father were interviewing these women, he in return was interviewed by their parents. He had to sit and face their interview by these girls. And their fathers had said that, you know, where are you taking our daughters? What are you doing with them? Will we ever see them? Where is Korea? So all these questions were asked, and my father actually had to sign on letters of guarantees that he would bring these women back to their families. It wasn't heard of that educated young girls were going away with a bunch of unmarried and married men, and the girls themselves were completely unmarried, and they would go off to Korea for 6 months. They didn't know whether they would come back. They didn't know what a garments factory was. So everything was based on a lot of trust and a lot of convincing that my father had to do with their parents. So that was a revolution. Once these women came back, they invited more women to come out from the homes in the villages, unheard of, unthinkable, from to come out and work. It was an idea which was absolutely unthought of in Bangladesh, that they would professionally come out to work, become income earners, go home with some money in their hands, and give it to their husbands. It was completely unheard of, because all these women, the part that they played before industrialization took place in the country was field work, was agricultural work. They would probably wake up in the morning and get prepared for their... I mean, this is honestly, this is what my father made. This is what my father think that these women would be able to do this hard labor. Because Bangladeshi women in the villages, they basically wake up at sunrise, at dawn, even before, a little before the sun rises. They prepare the food for their husbands, their children, their in-laws, their father-in-laws, brother-in-laws, everybody who stays with them in a little mud house. And she would prepare everything, and then husband would go off to the field. She would prepare the meal that he would take away. The children would probably get up and go to school. Probably not so much school back in the 70s, mind you. And they were hardworking. They looked after their home. They cleaned, they cooked, and they stitched. They stitched. They made everything. They made the clothes for their husbands. They made the clothes for their children. Because there was no sort of tailoring, garments, anything back then in Bangladesh. And this made him realize how strong these women were. Because midday, they would probably even make the meal for the husbands and take it out to the fields. Mm-hmm. So it was the women who was doing the labor-intensive part. And he saw that. He also had a horde of sisters. He had three sisters. So he was, and he was the youngest among his brothers and sisters. There were six of them. So he was always spending a lot of time with his sisters. So he saw them being feminine, stitching, being... My aunts are actually very educated. They can drive. They did all of that in the 60s. They're very independent women. So he took a lot of that away in him, that women should be empowered, should be educated. And then in the end, when he saw, as a patriot, that these were women who worked, who were active, who were strong, he put two and two together and he decided to use them. So there was... We all talk about the microcredit program and financing and all of that, which is also very popular in Bangladesh and which is also a revolution in Bangladesh against the whole world, showing the whole world what we can do with the microcredit program. And at the end of the day, when you weigh it up, I may be biased, but I believe that we have empowered them more. We have empowered them more in a very free way. In a very free-thinking way, not holding them back with interest rates or, you know, any collaterals and things like that with the microcredit program, whereby, yes, the loan is collateral-free, but then you're tied up in an interest program, whereas you have to give the money back to these microcredit banks. With us, it's different. You come to work from the village. Maybe you don't have a skill. Most of the time, they don't have a skill. You come to us. We train, we take them on, almost as apprentices. We train them in a skill, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and then they're ready to go. They're full-fledged workers. They work in the factories. Of course, we give them the legal minimum wage. Then beyond 8 hours, we start giving them overtime. They can work up to 10 hours. Anything beyond that, the minimum wage they get for overtime is double the base rate that they get for their general work during the first 8 hours. Then they get tiffin. If they stay beyond, they get additional dinner, if at all it goes beyond, which it doesn't, because now being compliant factories, we all have to stay within the allocated overtime that is given to us by our buyers.
Right.
So it's a lot of things that we give to these women. There's healthcare in the factory. There's childcare in the factory. They get maternal benefits for 6 months unpaid leave, which is, I think, possibly a better deal for women who are in labor or pregnant mothers in America, maybe even, that we give them 6 months paid leave. And there are other government benefits such as lactating mothers, milk program, and nutritional programs, there is the HER project. There are all kinds of these little projects which work within a factory also. So these women have rights. There are welfare officers within the factory to which they can, whom they can talk to about issues, domestic issues and things like that. There are pro bono lawyers who offer these women advice if they need any legal advices. So there are all kinds of things that happen for these women in this industry, whether it's directly through our government, whether it's through our buyers, whether it's just through an individual who wants to help women in this industry. So I think, you know, it's a silent revolution that has taken place. But this silent revolution has become so gigantic and so enormous that today there are 4.5 million women working in this industry, well, workers working in this industry, out of which 85% are women.
So it's driven by women. That is so amazing to hear. Absolutely. When we come back from our first break video, we're going to talk more about the garment industry as well as your work within DESH. But for right now, I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to connect with us and let us know what you think of this conversation by going to facebook.com/womeninvesting. Or on Twitter, be sure to comment and use the hashtags WomenInvest, #GirlsInvest, and #WeForShe. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls.
Welcome back to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are in our conversation with our lovely guest today on our program, VidiaCon of DESH, which is a garment company, a garment factory company in Bangladesh. So, Vidya, welcome back, and I'd love to go now into talking more about DESH. So if you could just tell us more about DESH Garments Limited and your role within that company as well.
DESH Garments Limited was established in 1977. They took on the workers in 1978. They were sent away for training for 6 months. They came back in 1979. And the first set of exports were to a German company called M&R for boys' shirts in January 1980. So that is the practical, the timeline of DESH Garments. I was born in 1980. So the factory pretty much took off at the same time that, you know, I came to this world. As I was growing up, I saw my father. He never really quite brought back work home. So it was difficult to, understand the volume of what he was doing. When we were growing up, until much later, I understood that it was the first factory and there's so much history and so much legacy. So when we were growing up, it wasn't like I knew what was going on. It was much later that I understood what was going on. Unfortunately, DESH Garments suffered. It suffered in many ways. When my father had sent these 130 people to Korea, he had a joint venture agreement. He had an internal agreement with them that once they came back after being trained, that they wouldn't go away for about 5 years or something like that. But at the end of the first year, people started getting interested, and his friends would come up to him and say, Nurul, you have 130 people. Give us one or give us two. It's not going to hurt you. And he did. He didn't mind. And that factor came from the fact that he was a civil servant. He was a patriot. He was a freedom fighter. And he was a visionary. He wasn't just a businessman. It wasn't like he was an entrepreneur. No, he was a visionary. So he wanted to see industrialization grow in Bangladesh. He wanted to see the people being employed. So he let them go. And soon these 130 people started going, and people started coming back and forth and asking him for advice. And it was like a huge industry growing, and my father being, today he's known as the father of the garment industry of Bangladesh, and he really played that role. He played that role as a caring individual for his country, wanting to give something back to this country. Mm-hmm. And what he really did give to Bangladesh was industrialization. We only had the jute industry, which was dying after nationalization in this country after the war. So there was nothing. There was a few trading businesses that happened, and that was about it. So that is Desh. Today, in 1987, my father had lung cancer. We moved to London for about a couple of years then. His left lung was removed, and we were there for 2 years, hence the factory suffered at that time. There was rumor he was dying. He was in a coma for 13 days. So there was rumor he was dying and he was dead. We were little. I was 7. My brother was about 13. He was about 13. My mother was very young herself. We didn't know what was going on. The factory suffered. It's not like we could have taken on the business. The people thought he was dying. So as it happens, that they took advantage of the situation and the factory didn't perform. He didn't die. We did come back and he took on the reins again. But unfortunately, in 1991, the great cyclone took place in Bangladesh, which killed hundreds and thousands of people. Our factory was completely flooded. And at that time, the current value of losses, I mean, if I were to take in the value that it would be today, there were losses of about $2 million back then. So that was huge. $2 million today back then was probably about $10 million today. It was huge. We used to bank with BCCI, which is a bank based out of Hong Kong. They didn't pay up insurance, and unfortunately, it was exactly the same year that they declared bankruptcy. So we never got any insurance money. So the factory couldn't be revived. And again, for 6 long years, it was shut down because we had ended up with huge debts to the customers, to the bank, and the pay-up was insane. In 1996, the factory restarted. We had other garments factories in between, but then it wasn't Desh. Desh was Desh. Desh is still Desh. And in 1996, he opened up the factory, started running it again. In 1998, he died. So again, he couldn't really take off with the factory. What Desh has become is more of an institution rather than just a bog standard business unit. Today, in 2005, I came back to Bangladesh, but it wasn't until 2008 that I had taken on Desh Garments. And the reason why I had decided to take it on was because we came to a standstill. We came to a point because we are also public limited. So it's not like it's a private company with limited liability and then I don't have to answer to anybody. It's not nothing like that. I have shareholders to whom I have to have an annual general meeting and reply as to what is going on with my company. Mm-hmm. So in 2008, we came to a crossroad, just the beginning of 2008, we came to a crossroad to decide whether we wanted to continue with Desh or whether we should think otherwise. At that point, I was looking after other parts of our businesses, which were easy, which were fancy, which was hardly any hard work, now that I come to think of it. And there was a decision that needed to be taken. What do we do with Desh? So given that the factory is in Chittagong, which is the port city, and a 45-minute flight away from where my home is, where our head office is, where we operate and live from, it was a question. We realized that somebody needed to go and do the day-to-day functions if the factory at all had to run. And who would be that person? Chittagong is a city where there isn't much that is happening, apart from business and things like that. There isn't, you know, for somebody who had just come back from London, the social factor, the social life, it was dead, almost non-existent.
Right.
So
right.
It was like, what? So then, of course, I decided that you can't, I mean, although business is not supposed to be personal, but in this case, it was personal. It was Desh Garments. It was a legacy. It was the first factory. It's something that my father had worked hard for all his life to set up. It is what we were known for. So then I decided that that's it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to fix the factory. And it was very easily said and done. And my mother said, you have no idea what it is to look after a garments factory. And I said, well, there are about 4,000 factories in Bangladesh, probably about 3,000 owners. If they can do it, why can't I? So I took on the job. I took on a consultant who was German the next day. I found him in the newspapers. It was a coincidence. I took him to the factory. I showed him the factory and I asked him, can you fix it? He said, I can, but it would be a lot of hard work and you would have to be really hands-on. I said, sure, I have nothing to do. I'll do it. So within a week, I moved to Chittagong with my consultant and I started the journey to fix Tej garments. And that's how I got involved. I am a director of the company. I am a director of the group of companies. My mother is the chairman, my brother being the managing director, and I am the director. So technically, they are all more senior than me. Tej Garments is our mother company. But it so happened that when I took on, I really took on. And I think they just realized that they shouldn't interfere. They should support me, but then they shouldn't interfere.
Right, I think that's a fantastic story, and I love the way that you, you know, even though you were younger, and you know, you were a woman, and sometimes, you know, in countries all over the world, women don't typically take positions like this, or at least not by themselves in some situations as well in different countries. So what an incredible story. We will get back to this when we come back from our next break. We encourage you to let us know what you think of this conversation by going to facebook.com/womeninvesting or on Twitter. You can use the #womeninvest, #girlsinvest, and #WeForShe. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the State of Women Radio Network, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on women and girls, with your host, Michelle Jaffe.
And welcome back to Women Investing in Women and Girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe, and we are in our conversation with our guest today, Vidya Khan. And before we went to the break, we talked more about Desh and about the work that Vidya does within this company, in the garment sector in Bangladesh. And now, Vidya, I'd like to learn more about how you took on this role of director of this company. And I'd like to know from you, did you have a mentor to help you take on this new role? And if not, how did you learn all that you needed to be successful?
The position of the director is something that I was actually born into. It is quite simple as that. It was my inheritance. So I didn't really have to work for it. I just got it. It was there. I was a director from, I think, when I was 9 or something like that. Of course, I wasn't an active one, but it was my legacy. So that was easy. I got into it because it was just sheer love, passion, a payback, a gratitude, a feeling of doing something for my father, who had done so much for me as a child, who had taken so much care of me and completely spoiled me and all of that. So it was very normal for me to think that, you know, I owe him something. I owe his memory something. When you grow up with a lot of love and affection, it's very easy for you to think that I should pay it back. And I had that gratitude to my father. He was my everything. So while in my head, his memory was something that was enormously driving me. I had a lot of support from my mother. She was wonderful. And my brother, who being a man in this country, had very easily given up his position of being the person who was driving Desh. He absolutely had no problems. He said, you know, go ahead. If it's what you want to do, we'll support you. So from my family, I had none of that male thing going on. There was no problem. But I was in a very, very male-dominated industry, and even today. I had a mentor. It was my consultant. He was German. Most wonderful, most patient person ever, but patient with me, impatient with everything else. And he was as German as you could get. He wanted things on time. He didn't stand for an excuse. He took me to the lines in the factory, made me sit on the machines, understand how it works, what the different sizes of the needles were. In fact, he even taught me how to stitch. So I can possibly, I make shirts. Tej Garments specializes in shirts. And I can possibly make you a very bad one. but it was that man who made me become more disciplined, because before that I was the boss's daughter. I was the director. I used to wake up at 11. He changed my habits. He made me wake up at 6. And he made me realize that I must walk into the factory before my workers do. And which is what I did with him for 4.5 years, which is the time I spent in the factory. With and without him, both. I had to change management. I got rid of a lot of the old people who were there for 20, 25 years, who had become lethargic and, you know, very used to what they were doing and didn't want to change. I changed the entire system of way production used to take place. Traditionally, we used a lot of helpers. We were not very lean. We were not very efficient. I changed all of that. I brought in industrial engineering into the factory. They became more efficient. They were more answerable. The quality standards improved. My buyer clientele improved. At one point, I realized my marketing director wasn't doing the job he was supposed to. So I decided to release him, and I took on the job as marketing director. I don't have the title of marketing director. I'm just a director, but I've taken on the entire responsibility of doing the marketing myself. And of course, I have a team. So I did all of that. 4.5 years later, I came back to Dhaka, which is the capital, and I started sitting in the head office. Today, I am back. In fact, last night, I came back from Chittagong. Today, I am back and forth and back and forth continuously. And it works. And at the end of the month, at the end of the year, I'm looking to double my capacity. So I'm going into expansion. We run compliant factories. So none of the stuff that unfortunately you have seen on TV is a reality to me, post Rana Plaza and all that negative, unfortunate negative incident that took place and tragedy that took place. That picture that you see of garments factories on TV in the world, in the States, that none of that is my reality. So that's about it. That's how Desh operates today. So my mentor, the person who taught me to do things, would be my consultant. Huge support from my mother, my don't have a husband, my boyfriend, my brother, my family in general. Huge, huge moral support from them. Very patient. They dealt with all my mood swings, my ups and downs, my tantrums. And today I'm in a much better place. I'm happier. I think my workers are happier. And the factory runs. And inshallah, as we do in Islam, we hope and pray to God that we can expand at the end of the year. And I look forward to better things.
And that's excellent. You know, we talk on this show a lot the importance of having a great mentor in your life. And I think that your story just attests to how important it is to have someone like that, especially to help you with your career. And as far as expansion goes, of course, we wish you the best of success and the best of luck. That's incredible news. But now I do want to ask you a question about what it's like to be a female in this position. And first of all, if you have advice for women in executive positions in business such as yourself.
When my father passed away, my mother became the chairman of the company. She herself is a barrister. She's not a barrister, but she's a lawyer. She is an extremely strong, resilient woman, very calm. Extremely calm. I don't know how she does it. Very diplomatic. Doesn't annoy anybody. I'm the right opposite. But she was a huge support to me, and she made me realize that she was very young. She was about 17 years younger than my father. So she was herself a child when he died, almost, you know, in terms of how we were. And even she cried, saying that, "I think I lost my father. It feels like that." But then she was such a strong woman, and I saw her, and that had such a huge impact on me. And I thought, wow, if she can do it, so can I. And I was surrounded by strong women. My mother's best friend, who's a school principal, who runs a school, again, alone. She is a single woman, and in this country, she did it. Everything that she did by herself. Huge impact on me. It is very difficult. All, you see, the workers are all women, but that's about it. Today, we are training the supervisors and the mid-management to become women. Because if you're really leaving them at the worker level, you're not really empowering them in the long run, are you? So for me, my factory, I have my cutting in charge as a woman. My security guards are women. I have a lot of women who are in mid-management because I am a woman. So I support that idea. But when we talk about the top, when I talk about the top owners who are men and women, well, there aren't that many women on top, just like me. Yes, mm-hmm. there are women. There are wives, there are daughters, and there are sisters who are working with their fathers, husbands, and brothers. But they are not the ones who hold the reins of the company and steer it themselves. So I'm in a bit of a different position. 2 years ago, I ran for elections for the Bangladesh Garments Manufacturers and Exporters Association, and I became the only woman to be elected from the opposition party among 27 male directors. And I sat with them for 2 years in office. Yes, they were very polite. Yes, they were very respectable towards me. But then, you know, you get singled out.
Right.
You get singled out, you get left behind. They think that, you know, you're more of a showpiece, you know, that they can say that, hey, look, I have a woman on the board, so I'm gender equal. But how so are you gender equal?
So,
you have one woman among 27 men, that's not being equal, is it?
Right. So what advice do you have for women in that position? What's like your top piece of advice that you have for someone that might be in your position, in an executive position in a business? What would you like to tell them?
You know, all this time I have to say this. All this time, I thought that, you know, I am relatively good looking. I am educated. I come from a good family background. People know who I am with one name. I say Desh and they know who I am. I have all that going for me. And I thought, oh, all this woman empowerment, inequality, gender inequality stuff is banal. I didn't believe in it. I thought all these Women's Day things were things that were just attention-seeking to some extent. To some extent. Of course, I believe, I know that gender equality does not exist. And I think Norway is the one country where they are most gender equal. And even in a country like America, gender equality doesn't really exist. So I knew all of that. Until recently, I faced a couple of incidents myself where I realized, oh my goodness, regardless of who I am and how I can speak and being so resilient to anything that a man has ever said to me, I had become, or I felt like I was being pushed into a corner because I was a woman. And I really didn't want to pull out that, oh, I'm a woman card and, oh, I need, you know, I'm in being subjected to this, whatever it is. I didn't want to pull out that card, but in my head, I thought, oh my God, did I just become a victim of what I do not believe in? And to some extent, in whatever way, I had. And I realized that, oh my God, this whole gender equality thing is just for show in Bangladesh. I mean, not that they are not empowered. I mean, our prime minister is a woman, the opposition leader is a woman. So they are in top positions. But that workplace women gender inequality factor exists. Mm-hmm. It very much exists. And my advice would be to never lose faith, never forget for a minute who you are, what you are, and that nobody should ever be able to put you in a position and say or make you feel inferior even for a second. So it has to be all in your head. It has to be this power that you have in your head that I am who I am and that there is nobody who's going to tell me otherwise. It's terrific. That booming confidence that one must have. And this confidence will often get interpreted as you being, you know, over smart or upstart or being a snob and being full of yourself. But at the end of the day, who cares? Right. I run my show. I have to be answerable to my shareholders.
Right, right. And, you know,
I have to be answerable to my shareholders.
And Vidya, that is such incredible advice, and we encourage all of the women and young girls aspiring to be, you know, executives in a business to follow that advice, and anyone who wishes to be empowered. I think that is an incredible message. So, Vidya, thank you so much for being a part of our program. It was great to have you on our show.
Thank you very much. It was lovely talking to you as well.
Thank you. Remember, we do want you to connect with us by going to facebook.com/womeninvesting or on Twitter, use #womeninvest, #girlsinvest, or #weforshe. We'd like to thank you all for listening today. You've been listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls. This show is produced by the State of Women Radio Network, the first radio network for women and girls. I'm your host, Michelle Jaffe. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to Women Investing in Women and Girls with Michelle Jaffe. Download our shows on iTunes or listen on demand right here on thestateofwomen.com, the first and only global radio network focused exclusively on delivering the latest trends in investing, entrepreneurship, and global women's issues by and for women and girls.